This is the Invest It Best podcast, a show about investing and financial markets where you'll hear from some of Australia's top investment analysts and fund managers about their views on the market. The Invest It Best podcast is brought to you by Wilsons Advisory, one of Australia's leading financial advisory firms with a proud and successful history spanning over 125 years. All information discussed in this podcast is for general information purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. You should seek investment advice tailored to your circumstances before making any investment decision. This is the Invest It Best podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Invest It Best podcast. On this show, we frequently hear what's been going on across the market, both from a top down at the macro level and what's been going on in the global economy, but also from a bottom up and what's been going on with certain companies and sectors. Now, this episode, we're going to slightly change tack and look at an asset class, in particular, investing in transport logistics. Transport logistics investments have emerged in recent years in order to serve a growing capital shortfall within the global transport markets. That is to replace aging capacity and to add to this capacity too. In the past, these assets were funded by traditional financing sources, largely the leasing arms of commercial banks, but they have actually proactively reduced their commitment levels following the GFC. And commercial banks have been impacted by new regulatory capital constraints. So this has created an opportunity and why I want to discuss investing in transport logistics this episode. We're lucky to hear from an expert in this space, Anurag Agarwal, who is Head of Portfolio Management at the Global Transportation Group at JP Morgan Asset Management. Anurag, welcome to the Invest It Best podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Anurag, for listeners, we are speaking remotely, so maybe if you can share where in the world you're based right now.
That's always a good question, Ted, because the answer changes on a weekly basis. I have actually just finished a wonderful 9-day trip to Australia, where I was in Brisbane, Melbourne, and Sydney, but currently I'm in Dubai, hoping to be in New York, which is my home, by the weekend, but then I'm in Texas and DC next week, so... You know, if you ask me the question next week, the answer will change.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time out in this in your busy schedule for this conversation today. And maybe let's just start off with a very basic area for listeners. You know, what is so appealing about investing in transport assets like ships and planes?
That's a really important question. And I think oftentimes it's a question that doesn't really live in the consciousness of both investors and consumers at large. Let me start off by sharing with you a really interesting statistic. 90% of everything in the world that is consumed travels on water at some point. And in our business of transport, we often say, if it doesn't float, it flies. So now when you put that question back into context, you can realize for 8+ billion people on this planet that live in very geographically dispersed regions and continents, there is a significant amount of trade and trade-based consumption that is happening, be it across energy and energy-related commodities, food commodities, finished goods, which are containerized goods. For Australians, I'm sure you're very familiar with mining as an industry, all the iron ore that comes out of Australia, all of that cargo has to move on ships. So shipping in many ways is considered to be the arteries of global trade. And then of course, for all of us that travel the world, we know that flying is equally important because it is the most effective from a time point of view and cost point of view way for humans to travel and for high value goods or time sensitive goods like vaccines and chips and things like that. They have been known to be transported by planes as well. So really critical industry, the backbone of global trade, and arguably the tail that wags the dog, because without transport, there is no global trade.
I really like that line that you said in your answer there, that shipping are the arteries of global trade. Are there any other transport assets aside from ships, and for that matter, planes, which you mentioned too, that often sit within this asset class?
They are. And I think for that, we have to separate the world of transport into assets that are truly global in nature. So they are mobile and they use oceans and the skies. So ships and planes obviously are the international or the global assets that move across borders. But once the cargoes reach the ports or the airports, there is a whole different landscape of distribution of the cargoes that requires rail on one hand. So rail is the next most scalable and efficient form of transport. And then after rail, it's the land-based transport, which for commercial goods is trucks, you know, or chassis, as we like to think of them. And then, of course, cars for passengers. So in the continuum of transport, I would say rail is probably the one I would talk about here, which is an incredibly important way to transport cargoes on an intermodal basis domestically. And then the last mile typically is done on wheels, which is trucks. And
let's go back to shipping where we started here. If you're investing in transport where, you know, ships and other expensive assets are moving around the world, it would be remiss of me not to call out that many geopolitical events have happened in recent years, from COVID, the Middle Eastern conflict, even Russia and the Ukraine war. And many of these geopolitical events have significantly impacted supply chains. So now, generally speaking, what has happened to cash flows and valuations of these assets like ships during these times?
Yeah, it's a question that comes up a lot these days. And quite interestingly, this is one sector that actually has done quite the opposite of what people expect or have experienced during the pandemic or during these periods of conflict or events of conflict that we're experiencing around the world. And let me try and elaborate on that. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, transport is effectively the only way goods can travel from one part of the world to the other. And in the pandemic, starting with that event, what happened was while we were all in lockdowns and borders were shut, it's not that people stopped consuming. So non-discretionary goods were needed and kept moving because without them, there was no consumption. It's the discretionary goods that where the demand possibly slowed down. But even there, we saw the effect of people sitting at home, not spending money in restaurants or on travel. So they were really shopping online. And that created an extraordinary demand, or, you know, it's also called the Amazon effect or the Walmart effect, where people were just clicking away and buying stuff. And that meant that all that stuff had to come from China in the most cases, where you have the finished goods and they come on containers to different parts of the world. Now, because the entire supply chain of the world was slowing down, the number of ships which remained the same could only move, you know, as much as only 2/3 of the cargo that they were traditionally used to moving because of the fact that more time was being taken. So a ship that was doing 6 round trips from Asia to North America was effectively doing between 3 and 4 round trips. Now imagine a global fleet of 50,000 ships all being slowed down by about 1/3. That's about 15,000 ships worth of cargo that is no longer moving. So what would that do? Naturally, that would create a greater demand for assets. And that means lease rates would go up and asset values would go up. So what we experienced in the pandemic was, and for those that were actually in the midst of a renovation, you certainly felt the pinch. Because if it cost you $1,800 to move a container worth of goods from China to the US, that price went up to $4,000. And that does not take into account the slowing down of the fact that the goods were just not being produced and delivered on time. So that was one phenomenon. Let's look at Russia-Ukraine. Russia is the largest exporter of fertilizers in the world. We know that Russia was also the only producer and supplier of natural gas into Western Europe through its two pipelines, Nord Stream 1 and 2. We wake up one morning and Russia decides to invade Ukraine and they get sanctioned. So overnight, the entire supply chain of the commodities that were being exported out of China gets affected. And for Western Europe in particular, that is highly dependent on the commodity of natural gas to provide their people with heat and electricity and power. They now have to go to other parts of the world where the commodity is available. Now, what are those parts of the world? It's Qatar, which has about 10% of the world's gas. It is the US and Canada, so North America. And to some extent, Australia. There are no pipelines from these countries into Western Europe. So that created a significant amount of demand for a transport asset called the liquid natural gas carrier, which we also tend to think of as a pipeline. So there again, a disruption in the underlying supply chain of a commodity because of a geopolitical event actually ended up creating demand and increasing both asset values and lease rates for that underlying type of asset. So we're seeing that again play out right now in the Middle East. As we are seeing ships being attacked as they're trying to access the Suez Canal in the Middle East by the Houthis, allegedly, you're seeing more and more ships being rerouted away from the Suez Canal. And now they're having to go around Africa or the Horn of Africa, which adds anywhere from 13 to 15 days on the low end, sometimes as much as 20 days of additional voyage time. So now you have the same cargo on the same vessel taking 15 to 20 extra days to be delivered, which means 15 to 20 days of extra costs, which means 15 to 20 days of more work, which again puts a significant amount of pressure on the supply side of how much cargo can be moved from point A to point B over let's say a year or so. And that's caused higher lease rates again, and asset values seem to be going up again for those assets that are being used in that trade. So all of this to say, Ted, that at the end of the day, what we have experienced now is over a pretty long period of time, going on over 5 years, every time there has been a supply chain shock or a geopolitical event like a conflict or a war, transport, and I'm not certainly proud or happy to say this, but it is my job, so I will say it, has benefited because of the fact that it creates supply side pressure on the assets and demand remains the same or goes up in many cases. So for those in the audience that are thinking about ways to mitigate against geopolitical risk, one way to think about core transport is it can be a pretty effective way to actually have one type of asset in your portfolio that tends to benefit or tends to perform positively while most of the other assets in the portfolio could be getting impaired or getting affected negatively.
It's very interesting. Now, let's look at this asset class relative to other asset classes. In recent years, we've been seeing increased correlations between the likes of equities and bonds, which have become more correlated. Now, generally speaking, what does the correlation and volatility of these transport assets look like through the cycle?
It's been a lot in focus because I think having correlated assets in a portfolio has added to the risk profile of the overall portfolio. And one of the things that I often hear all over the world is how in the last sort of 5 years, equities and bonds have certainly started to show more correlation. And that has created an additional need to find asset classes that provide diversification from a correlation point of view in a portfolio. So one of the benefits of real assets in the private markets world, and within real assets, I would say infrastructure, both fixed and moving assets, you know, transport tends to be the moving assets. One of the other benefits of not only having income being generated from these strategies, which certainly helps a portfolio, but it's really been the fact that these asset classes are negatively correlated to public equities and public bonds. And that is a really important point to highlight, because for those, again, in the audience, looking for uncorrelated sources of income, you can actually get that. And oftentimes you hear of the word defensive allocations. So what these asset classes have ended up becoming is defensive allocations that can replicate the behavior of income generating assets like fixed income or in the credit markets if they're public, but they add diversification because of the lack of correlation to public markets. What makes it even more interesting from a transport perspective is that we are also negatively correlated to fixed infrastructure assets. So that means even within the infrastructure allocation, you're able to get diversification by combining fixed and moving infrastructure assets. So this is a very important question. And I would argue while the income profile of the asset class is very attractive, we should not lose sight of the fact that it is really the diversification benefits that we're after as we think about portfolio construction for the next cycle?
Okay, so the benefits, defensive investment that increases diversification and lowering volatility are apparent, which we've touched on. Anurag, maybe if we can look at the flip side of that, what are the risks investors need to be aware of when investing in this asset class?
Look, there are certainly risks in investing in any strategy that you are not buying and selling off a screen, or that is not trading, without any operating element to it. So let's sort of deconstruct this question a little bit, and we'll talk about the risks as we go along. So first and foremost, we have to understand that these are private market strategies, so you are taking a liquidity risk. So you don't get to trade in and out of these strategies. So you need to invest capital that you can actually invest for a certain period of time. I always like to inform the people I speak with, your investment horizon should be no less than 5 years as you think about investing in strategies like this, because that's where you also accrue the benefits of that diversification and income generation that we were talking about. The second risk always is, in a private strategy, the manager risk. You are, at the end of the day, betting on a team that is investing capital on a certain investment thesis. And I think track record, their ability to have stuck to their knitting in many ways of having pursued that investment thesis with the backdrop of volatile markets and changing markets. And, as we have all recently experienced, not one or two, but multiple black swan events. I'd like to think of those, I refer to them as a gander of black swans that have come our way. I think most managers at this point have to stand behind their track record over the last 5 years. So certainly the ability for a manager to execute on the investment thesis is a critical component of risk. And that is something that investors should think about, because your ability to achieve the results that are being expected is oftentimes directly correlated to the ability of the manager. So that's two. I think three is size of the underlying investment platform, because size creates diversification and diversification mitigates risk. So I think when you think about investing in the early stages of a fund's life, you're clearly taking a little more risk, in my opinion, because that strategy is just starting to build on that diversification. So I like to think of that risk as concentration risk. So you are taking a little more concentration risk in your investments. As strategies mature, and this is where open-ended funds tend to have a benefit over closed-ended funds, because open-ended funds continue to deploy capital and diversify, you get that benefit of diversification, which is a great way to think about risk-adjusted return. So that's probably another specific element. And then when you go away from the underlying strategy and look at the world at large, I think you can't help ignore that you are dealing with certain elements of macro and geopolitical risk. So you have to look at the underlying behavior of asset classes. Again, the last 5 years have been a phenomenal stress test to check those out. And then for transport specifically, there is deglobalization that oftentimes comes up as a discussion point. Although there is no evidence to suggest that the West has the labor, the capital, or the will to move the factories outside of Asia, we think of reshoring really more as friendshoring, where if the factories have to leave China, for example, we've seen them move more to countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, and Indonesia, because you still need that labor arbitrage. So from a transport point of view, I'm agnostic of where I'm picking up the cargoes from in Asia, as long as I have to move the goods from Asia to the West.
Very interesting there. And we're going to touch on some of the areas within your answer there. But first, supply chain critical transport assets like ships require significant upfront investment. Who are the natural buyers of these assets? Is it the companies that utilize them, or is it other institutions?
So you touched upon this, Ted, in the early part of your introduction, where you spoke about how the incumbent source of providers of capital, which were the commercial banks and their leasing arms, were effectively pushed out of this market because of the post-GFC related regulation. So, 100%, I think I agree with you that this is a highly, highly capital intensive industry. And that's why managers like us see the opportunity. I think when you look at the total demand for capital for an industry that effectively has, you know, tens of thousands of ships and tens of thousands of planes globally, we're talking about, you know, in the next 10 years, over $3 trillion worth of capital that will be needed. So that just breaks down to roughly $300 billion a year. That kind of capital is not coming from any one source. It's going to come from multiple sources. It's going to come from institutions. It's going to come from some end users as well. But the challenge in transport has always been that the end users that need these assets are typically not in favor of buying and holding these assets on their balance sheet. They prefer to keep these assets off balance sheet because these assets tend to bring a lot of additional debt onto their balance sheets. They're dilutive to their EPS and they're non-core to their main business. If you're a mining company, for example, you're not served well by owning 200 ships because that's not your core business. So you're served better to lease these assets, gives you more flexibility to take these assets as per your need. So that creates a need for leasing capital. So what I will say is most of the capital, in my view, will potentially come from the private markets. It'll come from lessors. It'll come from leasing platforms like ours. And then it'll be a question of who has, going back to that idea of ability, experience, and track record, who, from a manager point of view, has the ability to participate in this market at scale and then deliver the best risk-adjusted returns.
That's very interesting. Before we jump into more details, Anurag, how does the leasing of these assets actually work?
Yeah, Ted, that's a really important question because it's important to understand that leasing is not a new business. It is certainly not a new behavior that we have had to teach large global end users. So the quick history here is leasing has been around for over 50 years. And when you think about the world's largest corporations, any corporation that has a physical good product or commodity in their underlying business. So, you know, when you think about mining companies like Rio Tinto, BHP Billiton, what is their main product? Iron ore. When you think about energy majors, their product is energy-related commodities. Food companies, food commodities. They effectively need to transport these underlying goods and products to effectively have a business. So what these large corporations have done historically is they've chosen to keep those transport assets that are critical to their core business off balance sheet by entering into leasing transactions, because by owning these assets, they only have to use up capital that they can use in their core business, and it is not very efficient for their EPS and or their balance sheet. So if you look at the balance sheets of all of the world's large asset intensive end users, you're going to find that most of the transport assets are off balance sheet. Now, the benefit of being a lessor is that once you enter into a leasing transaction, leasing contracts are legally written to be what's called take or pay contracts. So what that means is, as a lessor, I get access to the same corporate credit support to my lease obligation as one would get if you went out and bought a corporate bond issued by the same counterparty. So there is an apples to apples comparison that I think you can make between the performance of a lease and the performance of a corporate bond, and more importantly, the return and risk that a lessor takes versus a bondholder. And here is where, as a lessor, we have observed there are certain benefits when it comes to risk mitigation. One is, as a lessor, you own the asset, so you are collateralized. So your principal is secured in the collateral of the asset. Bondholders do not have that benefit. Two is, by accounting principles, the leases are classified to be core operating expenses. So they actually get serviced as a priority for cash flows. So you actually get paid much earlier in the priority of cash flows from the lessee as you would if you were a bondholder who sits right below in the capital structure as an unsecured debt obligation. So you collateralize and you get paid first. And then finally, because leasing does come with risk, because leasing does come with operating and residual value risk, you can actually make better returns than the comparable corporate bond spreads. So historically, we have seen that you can access the same corporate credit but outperform corporate bond spreads by effectively accessing that balance sheet credit as a lessor. So, you know, as I simply put it, You get paid first, you get paid more, and you are collateralized. So if you like corporate credit, leasing can be a very efficient way to actually access corporate credit.
Considering these sizable costs for these assets, does it mean that it's hard for new entrants to enter this market? As it sounds like the significant barriers of entry kind of create a moat here.
It is. It's hard to get into a market that has, you know, a certain degree of domain expertise needed. But let's look at all the elements that need to be brought to the table to execute, right? You need to have had, firstly, you need to have the investment team in place that understands the wide array of transport assets. I mean, we're talking about, it's easy to say shipping, but within shipping, there's a multitude of different assets. It's easy to say aviation, but within aviation, there's a multitude of different assets. So when you think about, you know, the investment process that one has to be familiar with, you have to have comfort, expertise, and experience to invest across what could be over 10, 15, 20 different types of assets if you're building a portfolio that is diversified. Two, you need access to capital. So you need to be in a position to not only have good investment experience, but there's no point of having that experience if you don't have the capital to deploy. So access to capital is a critical component. And then really deploying capital, because you're not buying securities off a screen, requires the operating and technical expertise to own these assets, which oftentimes you have to operate. So that creates, in my mind, the highest barrier to entry, which is, this is not something you can just show up with a lot of capital and just say, overnight, I'm going to be in the market. So there is barriers to entry, but there is a very attractive return profile that is available for those that can participate in the market. And we certainly feel like, you know, we've enjoyed that over the last few years. I think the market is deep enough that there will be more and more entrants that will come into the market. So I'd like to think of transport leasing in the early days of where infrastructure was, when we started seeing the privatizations and the need for CapEx, going back to the 90s and early 2000s. I think this industry is just starting to go through a process of institutionalization. And certainly that is going to attract more capital, a need for capital, more participants, but also more opportunities.
In your answer there, you mentioned the attractive return profile that it can provide. So going back to an investor's point of view, many funds in this area, you know, probably require some stability with their balance sheets and considering the quantum of the investments they're making. So probably have a lockup period of some time, which you actually touched on earlier of, I think you referenced, you know, like a 5-year timeline. A lockup period's common for investors in this area. And secondly, are investors compensated for this illiquidity?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, the answer is certainly relative based on the underlying focus of the strategies and the underlying focus on the assets and duration and the risk profile of what the underlying managers are trying to invest around. So I'm certainly not going to be able to give you an answer that is all encompassing, but what I can do is I can give you an answer that is based on our view and how we like to approach things. So the first question is, there isn't a given that there will be a lockup period, but I think lockup periods provide stability in that they allow for capital to be deployed, for consistent income to be generated, particularly in the context of leasing. So it just creates a little more organization around the ability to keep generating that income profile, especially in the early days when the underlying fund size is not very big. So it's basically just a way to mitigate some of that pressure of just having capital move in and out too quickly, right? Because these are hard assets. These are real assets. So you have to buy them, deploy them, let them generate the income. You don't just buy and sell them. So that's one big reason. So the lockup period can vary. It can be, again, based on the manager. But I don't think that should be a real concern, because I go back to this idea that if you're going to invest in private markets, you should come to these markets with a minimum 5-year investment horizon. So that, in most cases, will get you past any lockup period. So I don't think that should be as much of a concern. I think your second question is more interesting, is what kind of return should investors expect? Now, firstly, they should get compensated for illiquidity, no question about it. But I do think the type of return they expect should be a function of, what are you benchmarking that return against? Because once you have a benchmark, then you know what you are performing or underperforming against. So return in the absolute sense is less interesting in my mind than return that is on a relative basis compared to a benchmark. So the way I think about that in the context of transport leasing is if you are participating in a leasing strategy that is taking very high quality counterparty credit risk, so you're doing business with the world's largest corporations, you can actually measure what that quality of credit exposure is. And let's just say if that quality of credit exposure is investment grade, then you can compare that investment grade based return to other investment grade related credit opportunities that may be available to you either in the public markets through corporate bonds or through private credit or other sort of lending strategies. What we have evidenced is transport leasing can produce anywhere from a 300 to 500 basis points premium to underlying benchmark corporate spreads when done with the discipline and scale that mitigates a lot of the concentration levels of risk that we were talking about. So I would say that is where your illiquidity premium kicks in, but that is where also pretty attractive premium kicks in for taking comparable credit risk.
Anurag, one final question. Now, these assets, ships and planes, you know, no doubt run on traditional fuel sources, petrol, oil, but we are seeing the focus on ESG increasing and the energy transition playing out with EVs increasingly common on the road. So how is this impacting these assets? One, are there any shifts in demand that you're already noticing? And if so, what do new assets look like?
I think that's really the biggest question that the world at large is asking, especially given that we're all across the board, across every industry, focused on getting to our 2050 commitments around net zero. To set this up, let's first understand that all industries globally have committed, including transport, that they will get to net zero in 2050. Secondly, let's understand the context of the problem. I said 90% of the world's traded goods travel on water on ships. Now let me add to that through an ESG perspective, all of shipping contributes only 2.5% of the global emissions. It's one of the greatest myths that I spend my time debunking because people often associate shipping as a very large contributor to emissions. Aviation is actually a little over 3%. And the real culprit, if you're looking for one, is land-based transport, which is about 14-ish% of global emissions. So ships and planes have historically been the most efficient form of transport. And even those two industries are moving very clearly towards those net zero targets. I do think the need for ESG is driven, or ESG related investing is driven by regulation. Clearly the regulators have to mandate what is permissible from an emissions point of view. Once that is mandated, then the next stop is the stop of innovation. You have to have that technology and innovation available to build new engines, to have engines that can use alternative fuels. There's a big discussion in the industry about using alternative fuels, getting away from diesel to LNG, from LNG to ammonia, hydrogen, possibly small-scale nuclear, methanol. And each of these has pros and cons, but they are certainly better than the traditional fossil fuel-based diesel fuel. And then once you've got that, you need the logistics globally available to provide these fuels to a fleet that can be in any port of the world. So the logistics is no small challenge. And then when you've gotten past all of this, you need all the capital that is going to be needed, which is trillions and trillions of dollars. So I guess my approach to this is saying we see ESG as a huge opportunity. It's a risk if you invest in older assets that you're trying to eke out, you know, some return on in the remaining useful life that they have. But it's a complete opportunity if you take the view that you want to invest in the most latest, modern, scalable technologies, and you want to participate in this revolution, which is effectively driving this asset replacement cycle that'll get us all to this better net zero 2050 outcome. So we certainly take the latter view. We don't take short-term views in our investing approach. We like a longer-term view. We like young assets. We like modern assets. We believe in, you know, energy transition, decarbonization, the proliferance of renewables, offshore wind, electrification of the global fleet. these are the kinds of long-term macro themes that we're really focused on. So, you know, I will certainly agree with you that ESG is a bit of a question because it can be a risk as much as it can be an opportunity. We choose to look at it as an opportunity, and that's because of our long-term approach to investing in transport.
All right. Well, Anurag, on that opportunity, we might wrap it up there. It's been a fascinating discussion on this interesting asset class where we've covered everything from the benefits that this asset class can provide from increasing diversification and lowering portfolio correlations to the risks that we touched on, and then finally to with an ESG lens on how you're looking at this asset class. Anurag, thank you very much for taking the time to chat today.
Thank you, Ted. Pleasure to be here.
If you're interested in what we discussed in investing in transport logistics, then please speak with your Wilson's advisor. I'm Ted Richards, and thank you for listening to the Invest It Best podcast.
This podcast has been prepared by Wilson's Advisory and Stockbroking Limited. Wilson's has not independently verified any of the information given in this podcast, and no representation or warranty, express or implied, is made as to the accuracy or completeness of the information and opinions contained therein. All effort is made to ensure information was accurate at the time of recording. No reliance should be placed on this podcast in making any investment decision, and past performance is no indication of future performance. The directors of Wilson's advise that they and persons associated with them and Wilson's may have an interest in financial products referred to in this podcast.